Welcome to another episode of Europe's B2B SaaS Sales Podcast. Today with Martin Giese, true legend in especially Germany, author of Fast Forward, Accelerating B2B Sales for Startups. Specifically, this focus for German startups has worked with Hybris, LeanIX, Personio, and many more unicorn companies, not only on this journey from 0 to 10 million, which is hard, but then also how to scale from 10 million to 100 million annual recurring revenue. Today, you actually help startups as a coach, advisor, investor, and board members. And you mentioned like your North Star metric is that you can spend as close to 100% as possible of your time with startups, very little admin, very little other things. So thanks so much for taking the time, and over to you. And if you could also share two actionable insights, how as a startup founder, I can scale quickly from 10 to 100.
Yeah, happy to be here. And I actually brought three action items for your listeners. So the first one is go to your price list, look at it, and increase it by 20%. So it's clear finding is many startups are not aggressive enough in their pricing, and that's really a founder's role to push that envelope. And that was even for me a learning experience when we spoke to all those founders for the book, that they were very consistent. You rarely lose a deal only on price, but this extra margin will give you such a boost and so much more resources that it's very valuable. And the second actionable insight is around a KPI you should learn if you haven't yet. So it's about net revenue retention. That's a very valuable KPI for any SaaS type of business. And the underlying question is, how does the revenue from your existing customers develop? And I think you're all familiar with churn. If you have 100 customers with 100 units of revenue, you may only have 90 of them after a year, like 10% churn. But in the winning companies, they may still do 150 units of revenue out of those remaining 90 because they grow deeper into those customers. And if you go from 100 units of revenue to 150 over a year, it's a net revenue retention of 1.5. And that's an incredible predictor of success. So if that KPI looks good, investors will be interested. Yeah. Which brings me to my action item number three. If you find that your NRR is 2 or better, I want to get involved either as an investor or mentor. So please, in that case, go to LinkedIn, find me, contact me, and speak to me and prove your NRR above 2.
Yeah, and just for listeners that haven't had like a decade or more in like software as a service startup, like net revenue retention, like more high than 2 is like, if today I make a million in annual recurring revenue from like my 50 customers and without acquiring a new customer next year, I make 2, that's like higher than 2, right? So right now we, for example, work with a customer in the remote team building space, like payrolling, employee of record, that has a net revenue expansion of 4. So if they make 100K today, next time they make 500K, I'll ask them. Maybe also building on that, like how do you get to a high net revenue retention? I mean, product market fit is one answer. Customer success is another one. What do you see as the biggest differentiator between like positive net revenue retention startups and scale-ups and some that have a lower one and high churn?
I mean, it's a mindset that the first signature is only the start of a process and not the end of it. So there are just some fundamentals that need to be right. So your product needs to be functioning. It needs to work from day one with an easy onboarding, and it needs to get a high usage rate that it really goes into people's daily processes as a useful piece of their toolkit. And that's the basis. And then the mindset is really to see your customers as a source of additional revenue. So that's, in essence, is called customer success. So yeah, you have multiple ways to grow your revenue with existing customers. You cannot only prolong the contract, you can expand it. Often there is a neighboring division, an extra country served by your client, or your R&D team brings extra functionality out that you can price. And last but also important discipline, you may also be able to just increase prices. It's somewhat unpopular. It sounds mean to claim more, but especially now with inflation becoming a new reality, I think you need to have a process to put price increases into the system.
Yeah. So I think one and two are closely connected, right? Like you can actually achieve positive net revenue retention by just increasing prices. Like if nobody churns, you increase by 20%, you have 120% net revenue retention. Really simple. What does it then take for you as a scale up? Because at one point it's becoming harder to replace like $1 million in revenue compared to like 100K in the beginning. What do you do once you hit 10 million and it's really becoming a different beast, like on the deal size that you have, on team size, and it's also becoming less profitable at one point? Where do you see like this, what's called rule of 40 on profitability versus growth shifting in this scale up phase?
That's a lot of questions at one time, but first of all, probably if you reach 10 million and want to get to 100, you should take stock of where you are and what your momentum are. Yeah. And to get to 100, you need to have healthy fundamentals. If you got to 10, a lot of things must be functioning already, so you can build on those. You wouldn't get to 10 if you haven't develop a product that people can use and are willing to pay for, when you haven't found some segments willing to buy your product, when you haven't already standardized your sales process and found a meaningful way also to scale your resources. So these are the same levers you need to continue and optimize and develop excellence when you go to 100. And yeah, if any of those is a problem area, fixing any problem you still have in these disciplines is kind of the foundations to ever get to 100 million. The second is I'd say getting to 100 million with rapid growth also is a mindset. You also ask about case studies, like Personio is one of our rapidly growing Munich companies. And I remember when I spoke to the CEO, Hanno Renner, in 2019 for my other book on startup financing, I actually interviewed him in Silicon Valley because he was raising his next round purposefully in the US because he wanted to grow to 100 million. He said, no German VC has any track record in doing this, but I'm now speaking to those VCs that have done it a few times in the US because they... I assume they know how they did it and they have the deep pockets to support this journey. Now, 3 years forward, that's what he delivered. So he had this mindset to go there, and the company is now above 1,000 people. So they also opened the floodgates in order to allow this rapid growth. And yeah, that's kind of these opening the floodgates approach is also what I recommend you do. I sometimes see business plans that have a kind of very exponential, nice growth pattern. But the mental exercise I recommend, what if all my assumptions I put in my business plan are true? And a lot of startups put the assumption into their business plan that they can hire a salesperson, train him for 2 or 3 months, and starting in month 4, this salesperson does an incredible contribution to the revenue line.
Yeah.
If that is true, you're making a big mistake by only hiring 2 of those per month.
Yeah.
So if you're really confident that that is how the world works, and that you should because you put it in your plan, you should also think, why not hire 5, 10, 20 of those in this month and go through the exact same loop? And that's partly what I call the bottleneck analysis. Why not hire 10 times these salespeople? And then some startups, especially if it's software and you have very little service afterwards, may not have a logical reason not opening this. And if the world works as they put it into their plan, they should do it. For many other startups, if you ask this question, there's a wait a minute. I first need to improve my supply chain in order to service these customers. I shouldn't forget to hire these types of people. Oh, I can't go into the next segment because I need to do something on the product side. That's okay if you find those things, but then you have already found what is holding you back from growing to 100 million. So you should then work on those topics. And yeah. I always call this a bottleneck analysis, or the question, what could I do if I had unlimited funds? And that's often really insightful to do that on your business and see what is holding you back.
Yeah. Would you then say like it's more important to fix your bottlenecks and like basically eradicate technical debt or like sales debt that exists? Or would you say like, hey, focus on your strengths, like just make sure like the corpses in your basement don't get in the way? Because at one point you need to address like weaknesses around, for example, net revenue retention or around pricing or around the limited market.
Yeah. I think the approach is twofold. So if whatever you found a winning formula, you should serve it as much as you can. So you have, if you have a certain sales approach that works on one segment and it will only help you for a year, you still push it to the max and you use it. But what really lifts your potential is to addressing those bottlenecks.
Yeah.
If your product is missing critical functionality to address the next segment, that needs to be fixed as a top priority. If you have, I don't know, sometimes it's a certification, it's a legal issue, it's a language adaptation, you need to address those. And the worst is if you are losing more customers than you should, because that's like you're sitting in a boat that is running full of water and you have this little bucket.
It's not big enough and you sink and you go.
Yeah,
you die. So you,
quite frankly. Yeah, I mean, you just can't churn, especially if you are in an exponential growth curve. If churn isn't under control, you will put in an exponential number of companies, but you also have an exponentially growing outflow. And at some point, you'll just reach a steady state when you lose as much as your sales team adds on. And that's kind of a stagnation mode that also happens for startups and also for more mature subscription businesses. So always, if you do the modeling, just fixing 1% of churn probably is like 10% of your sales performance added. So it's just an incredibly valuable lever. And typically, if you work on focusing churn, you fix some fundamental issues because customers, you should assume your customers are smart. And if 20% or more are leaving during a year, something smells wrong with your product. And you should do good exit interviews. You should do good win back processes. And whatever you learn in this process, you should fix as a high priority.
Yeah. And I think that's just such an interesting insight that fixing churn is not a signal that that's actually, churn is a signal, but the reason, the root cause is often much deeper, right? If people don't get value or like they have a bad onboarding or they have bad offboarding or they don't have enough referrals or you don't price high enough, as you mentioned, how do you understand the signal to noise ratio here? If people like tell you like, we don't need you anymore because it's fine. Like, how do you know if it's a product, a marketing, a customer success, a sales, or an ideal customer profile fit issue? Because there's many variables, how do you deconstruct?
I mean, that's something that should be in the founder's toolbox because you likely did a successful customer discovery at the beginning of your journey. Personally going out, personally speaking to customers, spending more time listening than talking, and really digesting that information with a grain of salt, looking for patterns. Don't putting too much emphasis on any single opinion, but really trying to identify the pattern. And if they churn, of course, it's important whom do they churn to. Do they not replace your product? That would likely be an indication that value was mixed and or user experience not pleasant. If many of them churn to the same competitor, probably someone is eating your lunch and is doing something better. So you need to learn and catch up. So it's field research that you need to personally involve yourself, speak, and especially listen to people.
Yeah. I think that's a really important one that you mentioned, like how do you mix qualitative to quantitative and how you build like a mental model or a formal framework to take decisions on uncertainty. Because especially all that from play on the podcast today morning, they grew from 300 to 700 people in 4 months, which is intense. So how do you take decisions on the uncertainty at high quality?
I think the first important thing is you still need to take decisions. So I've seen also in larger corporations, the error mode, if the uncertainty goes up, to stop decision-making. And that's not helpful. And the systematic way is you kind of go back to the fundamentals. You ask yourself, what are the 5 hypotheses that need to work for us to work this? And you rank the hypothesis in kind of order. And you also do the mental exercise, how can I test this hypothesis with limited effort in a reasonable time frame?
Yeah.
That may change your ranking. Maybe you find a clever way to test your third most hypothesis, then it may still be the most useful thing to do if you have no easy way to test the first and the second one. And then you really kind of make your hypothesis, you design your mini experiment, and you watch the data. And experiment can mean you look into the future and observe something. It can be you talk to people. What people often overlook is you have this backwards mirror called all the data you have in your systems. And many things that look like an experiment going forward, you can ask backwards into your data. Yeah. And that's often the fastest way to find the insights you're looking for.
That's an interesting one. So you would do both. Like you look in the rearview mirror, like on how you gather data and like frame it as experiments. Like, okay, how would you have framed this as a hypothesis? And this is what we learned anyways, like even if you formulated it not as an experiment, but then also like, how can we right now craft an experiment which is allowing us to validate extremely quickly at low investment or focus time and energy and money, if that is true?
Yeah, I mean, that's also what many kind of portfolio managers in financial markets do. If they have like a clever hypothesis that they claim this will print money going forward, the diligent path is to try that same algorithm on real financial market data backwards. If the last 2 years you would have operated this investment strategy, would it have generated a profit? And that's it's not 100% foolproof, because the past may not be a total predictor of the future, but in terms of customer behavior, it can make a difference. Like you may, for example, have different packages, gold, silver, bronze, with different intensity of service. Then one question is to ask, does the intensity and easy access to service have an impact on churn? So then you may look backwards into your data, whether those that paid extra for service remain more loyal, and whether those that decided to be stingy on service are lost quicker. And if that is the case, then maybe your product portfolio isn't optimized.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And now switching gears maybe a bit towards sales talent, which is like a rough situation right now in Germany, Switzerland, Austria. But across the world, like there's lack of B2B SaaS or tech sales talent. How do you like increase your talent pool quickly without paying $250,000 and above for top talent that is hungry, humble, hands-on enough to succeed in a fast-changing environment?
I think one way is you can grow your talent. So sales isn't a stable lifelong career, and for the type of work you need mostly, like SDRs, even account executives, you probably can train smart people that are versatile enough and open to do it. So you don't need to find someone trained elsewhere with any kind of formal education. You need people with the right mindset, with the right attitude, who are outgoing, who are not hesitant to work the phone. And training those either out of university or out of other careers is probably more useful than having very tight-knit criteria of what exactly they should have done so far.
Yeah. So you seem to be a big fan of like hiring like not salespeople with a track record of like 10 years B2B sales. Like, so what do you think of these job ads? This is like 7 years of B2B direct like sales experience in a SaaS startup. So I find because of that, 7 years ago there haven't been so many SaaS startups.
They are foolish because they look for some proxy of the type of experience and especially personality that they look for. Sales is a learnable skill, and at least a certain fraction of is specific to each startup and is anyway learned on the product, on the customer segment, and by speaking to people. So probably you'd rather need to go to underlying skills and abilities of the person you're looking for than for a track record.
Yeah.
And that also said, even with looking for track record, the hiring in startups is faulty. I had some of the founders in the interview admit that about 1/3 of people they hire are released during the probation period.
So that's during the probation period, that's rough, right?
That's the first 6 months on the job. And they admitted this is the worst ratio of every department. So when they hire accountants, programmers, or others, they have lower ratios, and salespeople is worse, because somehow exactly this type of transfer from a CV, from performance in another context, and interview performance to performance on the job is relatively poor.
Yeah. I think a hard thing with salespeople is just that their job is selling, right? I mean, engineers will, when you ask an engineer, like, can you do it? You will say, like, with like an 87% certainty, and it means the data. If you tell a salespeople, like, can you close a million per year? I was just like, sure, yes, I will do it. Like, here's how amazing I am. And especially for founders with a technical background, it's harder to distinguish. So maybe also like a few like actionable insights. How do you distinguish like die Spreu from Weizen in German? How do you distinguish who's really an A-plus player in sales and who's a B player?
I think it's attitude, versatility, and going the extra mile in terms of kind of not getting discouraged. I mean, if you work on a pipeline type of approach, it often means you start 100 prospects to get to one or two sales. And with the wrong mindset, that can keep you down, because you'll have 98 no's for the two yeses to show. That means there will many days where you go home without a clear success. And that may frustrate many people. And it's kind of a question of mindset to kind of feel the progress while diligently working the pipeline. Someone who has a systematic understanding that he adds value by taking this client off the list as not relevant for the next 3 months. That's probably helpful in terms of mindset and motivation, but hard to understand that the no is more valuable than the maybe.
Yeah, and no, it's not nine, noch eine Information nötig, and just like create one more PowerPoint deck and one more POC and one more showcase, right?
Yeah, and it's the no from the customer is important. Even more important is a clever no, feeling that in the many small requests this other side has, there is a pattern that you will not get anywhere with decent effort. And absolutely, then moving on to the next one and getting that one through is important.
How do you validate this during like a talent acquisition process? So when you have somebody like think, okay, track record is not there, person is like cross, like not B2B SaaS sales, but seems to be very high on like coachability, attitude, hunger and drive, intelligence, curiosity, all the traits you're looking for. Person enters the interview process, is very likable, it's very smart. How do you manage to distinguish if this person will expose these traits on the job as well?
No easy answer. I think that's what we also asked the founders, and if they said, even with our good processes and better ratios in other areas, we still get it wrong too often for salespeople. They may be harder to evaluate because they are probably quite good communicators who yes, can kind of also find antennas to their counterpart and kind of sense the signals they are sensing the other side wants to hear. So probably you need to sometimes call it sense hot air. If someone is clearly over promising, too much adjusting to what you want to hear.
Yeah.
In the end, you need to hire out of the pool of people you find, you can afford, and you probably need to just try it out. And maybe part of the essence also is then not in the hiring to make them successful, but actually how you do your onboarding, how much guidance you give them when they come on board, how good are the scripts and actually the advice you're giving them, and are you creating an environment for them to be successful?
Absolutely. So I think that's a huge one that you just dropped here, and on the interview process, like a remote task of 1 to 3 hours, and like we really had like some people very that just that remote task was hot air, right? And that is the first time where it distinguishes between a dialogue and just literally like getting data, going deep, and not just having PowerPoint and polished speech. The second thing was also like a reference call with our current senior account executive. But the reference call is like, oh, you're free, like can I hire you back, which I found a pretty positive signal. So I think that's a huge one you're mentioning there, right? Because so many startups are like, oh, we hired this person and that person should have built up sales or like conquer like a new market or a new segment and didn't perform. So we fired the person. How do you feel, why do founders, sales leaders not basically help people more and in coaching and training and giving them the right tools and letting them ramp up like you would do in a sports team, right? Because you wouldn't hire Cristiano Ronaldo and don't give him shoes and a coach.
Good question. That's possibly something also about the founder's mindset relating to sales. And actually, Matthias and I start our book on B2B sales with a whole chapter telling the founder early sales is your job and you personally need to do it. It cannot be delegated because yes, it needs to be done with founder superpowers to take all your learnings back into product development, to adjust prices as needed, to just get the job done. And some founders endorse that, and they probably will also be great long-term leaders of the function because they kind of understand that this is actually part of the unique IP. Who is our segment? How do you sell to them? Who are the decision makers? And for each of them, what is the magic phrase to get past them? And if they really understand that they create value and have an attitude to share that, I'm very optimistic for the organization that they built. If you have a founder, a sales lead who'd rather be in the lab and sees doing sales as a temporary burden that he needs to get through before he hands it over to someone else, then probably this whole know-how transfer doesn't happen. And he'll probably hire with the wrong profile, and that person will have to reinvent the wheel again by learning the ropes, by speaking to customers, and getting this precious knowledge out of this founder's brain.
Yeah, no, amazing insights on that. Like, I mean, you spent like a decade, or probably two and a half decades in sales, but a decade with, specifically with scale-ups. What's your own number one source of still improving your sales skills, your knowledge, any people, podcasts, books you can recommend besides Fast Forward?
So for me, the number one learning is getting my hands dirty in working with real startups on real stories, because it's fascinating. There's always a common denominator of themes and challenges, and there's always a unique portion. And that's often something founders wonder why I often ask half an hour of questions about their product that I need to understand, their segment I need to understand before I may even start being helpful and producing output. But it's also always unique. So you have to see the pattern and the challenges you have in common, and then the unique challenges that sometimes need unique solutions to go along with them. But in terms of resources, I mean, the prerequisite for selling is a solid product. And the best guide for early stage companies looking at their product, in my view, is disciplined entrepreneurship from Bill Aulet, who runs the MIT incubator. Also has a very good workbook to really find your beachhead market. Your also look at your product always from the customer perspective. There's also good online resources, like a London VC, Balderton, publishes a sales B2B sales playbook that actually several of the founders recommended as having been helpful to them. And I'm sure I can give you some more to publish with the podcast on your site in terms of links and resources online.
Amazing. Yeah, we'd love that one. Thanks. And I mean, you mentioned an important point. You can sometimes only connect the dots looking backwards. I think Steve Jobs was a fan of that. What's one thing you would wish you would have known when you were 20 years old, and how old are you now?
I'm 51 years old. I think I only discovered like startups and entrepreneurships in my late 20s. And I think that has been a fascinating topic of study, because I like working with the people, because they are all self-motivated. And what I especially like is you have quick learning cycles. You may know in my CV, I worked in large global conglomerates. And that sometimes means you have a startup worthy, brilliant idea, like let's take the written letters that we get and have an AI read them and sort them. But that then takes 3 years within such a corporate to be put into practice. So you look for suppliers for half a year. You need 9 months to get through your budgeting process. Then IT is busy for 6 months before they find a window to work on your issue. And when the first letter is worked on, you have 3 years. And if you're in a fast moving career, you kind of need to swing by your former department to ask whether your product idea was any good. So you don't learn. And I always say with most of my work, I love to be active around market entry, or as I call it, when all those plausible PowerPoints hit reality. So when you try to get the first paying customer for your product, and that's typically a very condensed, intense phase in a startup history. And there is lots of learning to do and fine tuning and adjustment. And it's very iterative learning, because you have a real world counterpart that reacts to whatever you try to get along. So it's an interesting phase with very short learning cycles, where if you get things right, also a lot of value can be created.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So thanks so much for sharing all these insights. So wrapping it up on our conversation, how to scale 0 to 100 million annual recurring revenue quickly. I mean, you're true B2B startup sales legend that has worked with many hypergrowth scale-ups such as Personio, Hybris, LeanIX, and many more. Five things I took away from you is like increase your prices with confidence, go to your pricing page, increase prices by 20%, you could probably charge even more with that than that without losing deals, just because most startups don't price aggressively enough. Second, emphasize net NRR, net revenue retention, because achieving negative churn starts with your mindset that closing the deal is only the start. And it's really essential that you get this right. So aim for 100%. If you have more than 200%, directly get in touch with you, Martin, because you'd like to get involved then. The third one, that scaling, especially like 10 to 100 million, is also a mindset. And like Persona's founder, Hanno Renner, actually decided to raise his 2019 VC round in the US just because no VC in DACH had the track record or ambition to think this big. And you also encourage people to, why not hire 10x the people you do today if you believe it works, right? And then number four, you can't afford to not fix your bottlenecks, like most importantly, churn. If that's not under control, you will reach stagnation mode sooner or later. Like fixing 1% of churn might be equal to fix 10% of your sales performance. But that really means getting fundamentals and more right outside of just customer success. And the fifth one, you cannot afford not to take decisions. You need to validate hypothesis quickly, look back like on the experiments that you did, assess the past data, then define inexpensive experiments, validate them fast for the future, and then scale quickly.
Excellent summary. You just optimized my output by 10x.
Thanks so much. No, thanks so much for joining. Really looking forward to your masterclass mid-June with us, and also happy to link your book, which I can still recommend. It's the sales Bible of our CEO, Florian Lucy, for a reason. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. All the best.